Skincare experts and dermatologists have often touted the benefits of indoor humidity as essential for healthy, glowing skin. But did you know dry air can start to harm your skin in as little as 30 minutes? For years, many people have relied on humidifiers for better skin, sleep, and overall wellness. But traditional models? Bulky, mold-prone, and difficult to maintain. That's where Canopy Humidifier comes in. Recommended by leading dermatologists, Canopy is a completely reimagined humidifier designed to elevate any space, offering the ultimate in skincare and wellness benefits. Canopy's clean moisture combats dryness, dullness, and fine lines while strengthening the skin's barrier and boosting the effectiveness of topical skincare products. With its sleek design, Canopy is the cleanest and easiest humidifier on the market. With its unique technology, cleaning is as easy as popping it in the dishwasher. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy humidifier purchase today with Canopy's filter subscription. Even better, use code PODCAST at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Your skin well, thank you.
This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to break free from diet culture and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast about intuitive eating, health at every size, body liberation, and taking down diet culture. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, and author of the forthcoming book, Anti-Diet, Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating, which is available for pre-order now. Join me here every week as I talk with interesting people from all walks of life about their relationships with food and their bodies. And by the way, on this show, we bleep out diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to episode 216 of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm talking with eating disorder therapist and style blogger Shira Rosenbluth, better known as Shira Rose Online. Shira joins us to discuss how diet culture steals our money through the high cost and low effectiveness of much of the eating disorder treatment world, which is a topic that I touch on in my book, and I'm really glad to be able to get into it more here with someone who's gone through it and is going through it still. As you'll hear, Shira's story really shows that diet culture is rampant, even in many eating disorder treatment centers, even in the ones that say they get it. And so we need to root out this lingering diet culture if we ever want people in larger bodies to feel truly and completely supported in their eating disorder recovery. We also talk about why Shira decided to share her story as a therapist who treats eating disorders, who is currently recovering from her own eating disorder, fat phobia and eating disorder treatment centers and its effect on recovery, eating disorders as a form of trauma, and so much more. I also do just want to give a quick trigger warning for this episode because Shira is in really early stage recovery from an eating disorder, as opposed to a lot of our other guests who are in much later stage recovery or consider themselves fully recovered. And actually, in this episode, we talk about the concept of full recovery and why Shira is grappling with it or struggling with it. But I released this episode without a trigger warning at first and heard from a few people who are in recovery, you know, early stage recovery from eating disorders, that they found it a little bit triggering. There's no weight or calorie numbers mentioned. We bleep out some other numbers that Shira said later on in the episode, but some folks just felt that some of the early descriptions of her relationship with food and the struggles she's had in eating disorder treatment centers were a little triggering to people with active eating disorders. So just wanted to give that caveat. But all that being said, it's a great conversation and I cannot wait to share it with you in just a moment. But first, I'll answer this week's listener question. It's from a listener named Dale who writes, "How do you step into intuitive eating and away from structured meals when you work in an office environment and bring your own meals and snacks? I'm having a hard time figuring out how to truly intuitively eat in this setting due to my having to pre-pack food to bring to work. So thanks, Dale, for that great question. And before I answer, just my standard disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only and are not a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice. So this is a great question, and I think it gets at a misconception about intuitive eating, which is that intuitive eating is about always eating exactly what you're craving in any given moment. That's really not true. While it's certainly important to be able to eat what you're craving when it's available to you, when it's economically and logistically feasible, it isn't always going to be. And really, the ability to always eat exactly what you're craving in the moment without having to pre-pack or pre-plan is something that's only available to the extremely, extremely wealthy who have the ability to just order food every time they want something, right? Have Seamless or Postmates or whatever just deliver food constantly to their house, or have a private chef prepare food for every single meal and snack for the rest of their lives. It's just not feasible for the rest of us, right? For the rest of us, there are always going to be times that we need to pre-pack food or pre-plan what and where we're going to eat. And that is not antithetical to intuitive eating at all. In fact, it's a really important part of intuitive eating, because intuitive eating is about making sure we have enough food and have our needs for food met in whatever situation we're in. And for those of us who work in offices and can't afford to buy our meals and snacks out every day, or who work in workplaces where there isn't even anywhere nearby to buy food, we have to pack our meals and snacks in order to make sure that we have enough food and have our needs met, which is, again, you know, the central thing about intuitive eating. Those are the most important principles of intuitive eating. Now, the tricky thing about packing and planning meals is that diet culture in this day and age definitely makes quote-unquote meal prep a total thing, right? And if you look at Instagram in the hashtag meal prep, which I don't recommend, but just as a thought experiment, you would see that diet culture really has the lock on this concept of meal prep. And so when you're preparing and pre-packing meals to try to make sure you have enough and have your needs for food met in a way that's consistent with intuitive eating, it's important to make sure you're not meal prepping and packing in a diety way. And the key to that is keeping two things in mind: pleasure and abundance. So in order to help make these pre-packed meals and snacks as pleasurable and abundant as possible, it might help to start out by making a list of the lunches and snacks that you would just love to eat every day if diet culture weren't part of the equation at all. So if diet culture wasn't anywhere in the mix and you could just have your dream meals and snacks at the office, what would those be? Just let your mind run wild. Let yourself just make a list of everything you really want to eat at the office. And try to make your list include as wide a variety of foods as possible so that you have lots and lots of options, lots and lots of ideas. Then you can go to the grocery store and try to get as close to those foods as you can based on your budget, what's available near you, and all of that stuff. And then you'll prepare your food. Say, like, for example, you're like, ooh, I would really love pastrami sandwiches to have at the office. So you buy some prepackaged pastrami, or maybe you go to a deli and you get deli selection of it that's enough for a week's worth of sandwiches, right? You get some bread, you get some mustard, mayo, maybe lettuce and tomato, chips on the side. Maybe you get some other snacks to go with the lunch. And then you take that to the office and you see how it goes and you notice what satisfies you and what doesn't. So in our pastrami sandwich example, you're like, ooh, I really wish I had some pickles with this. Or, oh, I wish I had some like coleslaw on the side, you know, or in the sandwich. I want to get that for next time. Or these little bags of chips that I got just aren't really satisfying. I kind of want more chips to go with the sandwich. So next time I'll get bigger single serve bags of chips, or I'll get a big bag of chips and just bring that to the office and serve myself however much I want on a given day, right? So you can make adjustments based on what is satisfying to you, what gives you pleasure. And then next time you can put those things that you decided you want on your shopping list. And you might need to go shopping more often at first as you figure out what's really satisfying and pleasurable to you. And you'll likely need to add more food to whatever it is you pack, because diet culture's voice will probably still be strong in your head and it'll probably still be saying like, don't eat so much, pack a small portion, whatever, whatever. So it's going to be important to keep adding more food as you go and keep really listening to yourself in terms of what's actually satisfying and pleasurable. But bottom line is you can totally pre-pack and plan and use the experience of eating what you packed to make a different decision maybe for next time, or to recognize, oh, I loved this lunch. This is a great lunch. So I'm going to have this as a part of my repertoire. I'm going to buy ingredients for this next time I go to the grocery store too, and maybe have this be a standing item on my list. So I hope that's helpful. And just to reassure you, you definitely do not need to eat on demand exactly what you want in a given moment without any pre-planning every time, because that's just for people who have like oodles and oodles of money or a private chef. And obviously, if you're at the start of your intuitive eating path and you have the means to do this, then by all means, like buy food out all the time. That's great if that's what's satisfying to you. But I think in the long term, probably 99% of people listening wouldn't be able to sustain that forever. You wouldn't be able to Postmates or Seamless or whatever get delivery of your favorite foods in the moment every single time you wanted to eat, right? That's kind of a good short-term solution for people who can afford that, so that you can get used to having pleasurable foods, but that's not going to be a long-term solution. So for the vast, vast majority of us, we are going to need to have some pre-planned, pre-packed meals. And that is great. That is totally a part of intuitive eating. And don't let diet culture hijack that from us. So if you want to submit your own question for a chance to have it answered on an upcoming episode, you can go to christyharrison.com/questions. That's christyharrison.com/questions. And then if you want to ask me all your questions every month, you can come join my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. There, I do an exclusive monthly Q&A podcast just for course participants, where you get to ask me all your questions every month, and you get to listen to your answer and hundreds of other answers that I've given to your fellow participants already, so that you can work through pretty much any issue that comes up for you on the path to peace with food. When you join now, you'll get lifetime access to the course, which means you can keep getting support from me and my team as long as you want. And I can attest that people definitely do continue using the course again and again to support them and reinforce their anti-diet mindset for years after they join. And right now, for a limited time, when you pre-order my book, Anti-Diet, you'll also get a special deal on my Intuitive Eating Fundamentals course. To learn more about that deal and claim yours today, go to christyharrison.com/book. That's christyharrison.com/book. And at the bottom of the page, you'll see a little section about how you can claim your bonuses. And then if you want to read all about the Intuitive Eating Fundamentals course and how it can help you break free from diet culture and reclaim the life it stole from you, go to christyharrison.com/course. That's christyharrison.com/course. And now, without any further ado, let's go talk to Shira Rosenbluth. So tell me about your relationship with food growing up.
I think that's just an interesting question, because I feel like a lot of people that I know will have some sort of memory of just feeling carefree or like comfortable in their bodies, but I don't have a single memory like that. I think from my earliest memories is knowing that something was wrong with me and something was wrong with my body. And I knew, I mean, I grew up in a family with a lot of disordered eating. And so I knew from the time I was little that eating was wrong and my body was wrong and food was bad. I wasn't necessarily put on diets when I was a young kid, but I was given different food from everyone else in my family. And looking back, I actually wasn't that big or anything like that. So it's kind of interesting. But I guess because of my family's issues, I guess things were magnified for me. And so, yeah, I guess I really don't have a single okay memory of me, my body. I was told from the age of 5 that if I wanted to be loved, I needed to be thin. Pretty much like it was said to me. So that's what I knew. And that's kind of how I grew up.
God, that sounds so painful. And the fact that it was that explicit, I feel like is very rare. You don't often hear about families being that sort of on the nose with it. Like, if you want to be loved, you have to be thin.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously looking back in hindsight, I can see that those people that said those things to me were struggling with their own issues and they just didn't know better. But when you're a child, you can't understand that. And you just know something is so wrong with me. I can't be loved. Like, something must be very wrong with me. And then when I was 10, I was put on like a junior Weight Watchers diet. And within 2 weeks, my eating disorder developed. I guess I had all of the genetics and the environment and all that set up. And so it was within 2 weeks, one day I was on this diet. And the next thing I knew, I was binging and couldn't stop. And then I read a book about a girl with bulimia. And I was, and obviously, you know, people would be like, oh, that's a concern throwing up. But I was like, oh, that's a really smart idea. I can't control the eating and there's something I can do. And so my bulimia started pretty early when I was around 10 and kind of took a life force. And then I actually told the therapist, my parents got divorced around that time. And so I was seeing like the school counselor and I told her and she said, no, like you're probably not doing that because of my body. And my body didn't look like what she thought someone with an eating disorder should look like. So then my eating disorder went on for another 3 years before I got help at 14. And so it took 4 years before I even started getting treatment for that.
God, that is just horrifying that the counselor would say that to you. And so emblematic of how fat phobia hinders people from getting treatment and recovery and can literally kill, because that type of dismissal can lead people to struggle in silence and not get help for years, which then compounds the eating disorder and drives it further into your, you know, psyche so that it's much, much harder to recover from.
Yeah. And it's funny that you said that. I mean, it's not funny, but that you said it kills, because I mean, the only way I got help, when I've never shared this publicly, but I tried to kill myself when I was 14. And that's when things started to come out about my eating disorder. And that's the only way I got help, was when it got to that point, and it didn't have to get to that point. So, and I also had gone to a second therapist who actually did treat eating disorders. And so I told her what was going on. And she again was like, you don't have bulimia, you probably have binge eating disorder. And all you need to do is just cut out this food group, this food group, this food group, and only eat one food group. And like, that'll decrease your urge to binge. And so I just remember feeling so much shame, because all I wanted was to be able to just stop eating all of the foods she said I should stop eating, and I couldn't. And so then if I was feeling shame before, it only just escalated times a million, like after that conversation.
It's shocking to me that people who say they specialize in eating disorders will say those kinds of things to a client. It's just unbelievable. What business does she have saying that to anyone, you know? And that is someone who is supposed to be helping you. So of course it's going to feel very confusing, and like she's the authority figure. So of course you feel like you should believe what she's saying. She specializes in eating disorders. But, you know, seeing it from my perspective now, I'm just like, that is so patently wrong and false and does so much damage.
I think that was probably most of my treatment, was seeing professionals who then just further harmed me with their messages that were, like, as I know now as a professional, are just things that no one should ever, ever, ever tell anyone, and are so incredibly harmful.
Yeah. And so fat phobic.
So fat phobic. Yeah.
It just comes from that fat phobic belief that eating disorders, quote unquote, should look a certain way, even though we know the research shows that, and probably did even then, that people with bulimia don't look any different than anyone else. And people with eating disorders in general, you can't tell by looking at them, even if having anorexia sometimes means people's weights are suppressed, or having binge eating disorder sometimes means people's weights are higher. It's not like that across the board, and you can't generalize.
Right. Of course. I mean, I've had clients in all different bodies with all different eating disorders, and you wouldn't know their diagnosis based on what they look like. And it's such an awful misconception that's harming people every day.
Every day. Yeah. It's this sort of diagnosis on sight is just irresponsible and really just fat phobic.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like people looking at somebody that's fat and then deciding that they're unhealthy. It's the same thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that must have been really confusing then. I can imagine it would have driven your eating disorder further into the fore for you.
Yeah. I think even looking back, the amount of shame and self-hatred that I felt as such a little kid, it was only like further perpetuated by the conversations and therapy that I went to. And when I was 14, I ended up in my first inpatient treatment for my eating disorder, and I looked different from everybody else. And I remember the doctor on the first night there, the second night there, he looked at me and he said, oh, look, you like lost XX pounds overnight. Like, look what happens when you stop binging and purging. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I didn't eat there because I didn't have to eat there because I wasn't underweight. And so, yeah, I lost weight. And then I was congratulated for using a behavior that maybe somebody in a smaller body would be like, people would be all concerned about. But for me, it was congratulations and good job.
Oh, even though it's the same exact eating disorder behavior.
Exactly. But for me, it's awesome. Good job. Keep it up. Like, keep up that self-control, which is, I have no words. And so, and then the next treatment center I went to just a couple weeks later, because it was from inpatient to residential, and I went to this residential program, and I wasn't allowed to have snack. It was just like breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then I guess because my weight, like I wasn't even allowed to go into the dining room. Like I was, it was like different for me. And so I just like all of the messages given to me were, your body is different. You can't eat like everyone else. And yeah, purging is bad and binging is bad, but you know, everything else is fine.
Yeah. Restriction is fine. Cutting out foods is fine.
Right. And it's just also interesting to see just the way, so my eating disorder turned to anorexia when I was around 21. And at first I was crazed, obviously, because my body was doing what everybody's wanted my body to do my whole life. And then all of a sudden, like some people in my life started expressing concern. And I was like, you can't, like, why are you concerned now? It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, you hit some weird threshold where it was like the same behaviors that were disordered all along suddenly became concerning, as opposed to, no, you should have been concerned years and years ago when I started doing this in the first place.
Yeah. And for me, the restriction was like, look, I'm doing what you wanted me to do. I'm doing something right. I'm behaving. I'm putting myself in line. I'm putting my body in line. Like, I'm finally doing what everybody wanted me to do my whole life. And I felt good. Obviously, in hindsight, my eating disorder really shrunk my life in every way. But in that moment, I just knew that I could finally go into a store and find clothes that fit me. I could walk down the street and nobody would be judging me. If I wanted to eat, which at that point I was too scared to, but if I wanted to, I could, and nobody would look at me differently or make a comment under their breath. Like, I just finally was able to live in, the whole point was I just wanted to live in this world and feel safe in this world. And I had that, but it came at the cost of my life and everything else around me. So
yeah, you are shrinking yourself to fit this world that doesn't accommodate people in larger bodies, and shrinking your life in the process and just taking away your life. But there was that praise and that sort of like social acceptability that sounded like it kept you going.
Yeah, exactly.
And how interesting too, that going from binge eating to bulimia wasn't enough to sort of concern people with, okay, let's eradicate all of these behaviors. Let's like get at the root of why you think you need to be doing this. Because no one purges in a vacuum. No one uses any eating disorder behaviors in a vacuum. You know, why do you think you need to do this? It's because you think your body is wrong. It's because you think your body's too big. And let's push back against those ideas and let's actually help you recover. But instead, so many eating disorder treatment professionals, I think, have their own deeply internalized diet culture beliefs that say, oh yeah, larger bodies are bad and it's wrong and we should magically somehow take away these behaviors that are in the pursuit of thinness, but not actually take away the pursuit of thinness itself.
Right, exactly. I mean, there was a reason why I was doing the things I was doing. I think I didn't grow up with a single positive attachment, and I went through a lot of trauma and abuse, not from family, just in other areas. And all of those things drove my eating disorder and turned it into what it was. And All that mattered was, yeah, these behaviors and the size of my body. And, you know, if I had a client that came to me and was like, I need to lose weight, I would empathize with that feeling. But I mean, hopefully talk about the reasons why it was such a desperation and not kind of collude, because I felt like I would come in and then people would collude with my eating disorder. And so that didn't keep me safe at all. That just perpetuated and kind of just strengthened this drive to be smaller and this like desperation, you know?
Of course. Yeah. It totally colludes with the eating disorder. I feel like that's something that I've never seen a treatment center that didn't have some level of that hanging around. And I think the good ones are like looking at that and sort of unearthing it in their staffs and in themselves and their materials and pushing to do better. But the ones that you encountered, it sounds like, and the outpatient and inpatient providers, sounds like they were just right in it and they weren't doing that work to push back against it for themselves.
But you know what though? I think even the treatment centers now that say, oh, we're health at every size and we're looking at our actions. I've been in treatment. So I wasn't in treatment at all from my 20s. I was sicker than I ever was, but I don't think I knew it. And I think my behaviors were praised and I couldn't see things the way they were. But this past year and a half or the past 2 years, things have become like, I don't want to say relapse because I don't think I ever recovered, but things became pretty like severe again. Or I guess, you know what, they were severe all along, but I guess my weight dropped and people were concerned and it got really bad. And so I was kind of in and out of treatment this past year and a half. And I mean, these treatment centers were, a lot of them, or no, all of them claim to be health at every size. And the things that I went through there were anything but health at every size. And so now I'm very skeptical when people, when I see other professionals recommending a place and saying that health at every size, they're recommending a therapist. I mean, my first treatment center, the first residential stay that I had like a year and a couple months ago, I was put on this meal plan, which in hindsight, looking back, I was very, very malnourished. Maybe I wasn't like underweight according to the BMI, but it happens to be in this case, I did lose a lot of weight, but I just wasn't, I guess, what they decided a restoration meal plan should be. And all of this is just like, I'm saying this very sarcastically, but I was very malnourished. I was not okay. I probably needed a lot more food to like repair my organs. And I was hungry from morning to night. And all I did, so I was on this meal plan where we had to measure every single last tortilla chip and every single last piece of everything crackling off pieces and breaking and like to get to the last ounce and like measuring our turkey and like weighing our food. And like, if you think that somebody with an eating disorder should be doing that, it's absurd to me. And so I like came in there really not measuring my food. And I came out obsessively counting and calculating and measuring every last thing that I put in my mouth because I'm learning. I'm literally learning in treatment. Every single piece of food needs to be accounted for. And how is that okay? I remember having to like decide, do I want to have a good afternoon snack or do I want to have a good night snack? Because depending on where I had like my exchanges and I would only have a certain amount left for the night. And so I had to decide where I'm going to have my diety snack and where I'm going to have my good snack. And it only made me leave more obsessed and more, and just knowing that like all of this mattered so, so, so much. And that's, I don't have any words to describe like how that really hurt me.
Yeah. I mean, that is so fucked up, honestly. Like that it's just the worst treatment I can imagine for someone with an eating disorder. Like, for the love of God, you should know that people with eating disorders, like, you know, the treatment center should know that people with eating disorders have as a behavior often weighing and measuring and being obsessed with the exact amount of food they're eating. And if someone comes in and doesn't have that behavior and you're teaching it to them while they're in that disordered state, like, what do you think is going to happen? You know, of course you left feeling obsessed with that stuff. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And this is a place that calls themselves Health Every Size. I remember having like multiple conversations with my therapist and I would talk about my fear of going back to my larger body, which is likely to happen when I start eating again, but I hadn't gained that much weight there. And she's like, look what happens when you follow your meal plan exactly. Like, you're probably not going to go back to where you were. And she would say that over and over and over. And I remember just thinking, well, number one, I remember feeling hungry all the time. So I probably wasn't getting like the amount of food that I needed. And then thinking like, oh, I guess I have to be a little bit hungry if I want to maintain this weight that she's telling me I could probably maintain. And then I left treatment and my body started to go back closer to where it was prior to restriction. And I freaked out because she promised me that it probably wouldn't happen. And so I didn't know what to do. And then I went straight back to restricting. And then, you know, I have a friend who's a dietitian and she kind of explained to me, like, you probably didn't gain weight because your body was repairing like its organs and now it's feeling more comfortable and it's going back to where it wants to be. But I didn't have that conversation. And I just, the whole way, everything there kind of like did not set me up for success.
No. And it's awful that they call themselves Health at Every Size too, with that kind of treatment of people, because Health at Every Size is not just saying like all bodies are worthy or, you know, talking a big game about how we treat everybody equally. It's literally those little sort of moment to moment things. And in like how you craft someone's meal plan, because it says a lot, it like is really telling you something. And I'm sure you picked up on this, that you had such a calorie controlled meal plan that like a few crackles of a chip would make a difference, you know, like
Right. That's
like feeding your eating disorder this information that like, oh, my body size is so, you know, I have to maintain it with such a iron fist or else it's going to get out of control.
Right. Yeah. I'm starting to feel more and more angry. I think I think the reason, obviously, I'm angry for a lot of reasons, but I think because now I'm seeing so many professionals in this field just do further harm. And then people are concerned about the fact that I'm a therapist and happen to have an eating disorder. And I'm like, you're concerned about me. I'm concerned about our entire fucking field, you know?
Yes. Yeah, seriously. Like, actually, your perspective on things is probably a lot more attuned than a lot of the people that were putting you on those ridiculous meal plans in the first place.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that, you know, being a therapist in this field, how you got into that role, and then how it was to be struggling with an eating disorder and now being publicly getting treatment for an eating disorder while a therapist.
I think, so I actually did not go into eating disorders intentionally. It kind of happened by accident. I was working in a outpatient mental health clinic right after graduate school, and I was working with kids and families, and I mean, it was outpatient, so it was general, like everything and anything. And then I received my first client who had an eating disorder. We did really good work together and I loved it. And my supervisor noticed the work I did with her and that it was what she liked. And so she gave me the next client with an eating disorder. And then before I knew it, I kind of became the unofficial eating disorder therapist of the clinic. It was just, and that's when I kind of knew this is what I was meant to do. And this is what I need to do with my life. It was the first time that I felt passion and excitement and love for the work that I do. And I just knew that this is what I needed to be doing. And so after I got my hours to become a clinical social worker, I then pursued it specifically and worked for a therapist who treats eating disorders in her private practice and started doing that. And so I was a little nervous because everything that we hear is like, if you are struggling with an eating disorder, you should never, ever, ever do this until you're 100% fully, fully recovered. And first of all, I feel like the idea of full recovery is unfair to, I mean, not everyone has access, not everyone has money, not everyone has, I mean, recovering in a larger body versus recovering in a, there's so many things that go into recovery that I just.
Trauma that you experienced as a kid and like the deep scars that can leave too.
Exactly. And so I just hate the idea of full recovery because what does that even mean, especially in this world where, you know, the majority of people have disordered eating. So I was pretty anxious about that, but I had my own therapist, I had my own dietitian, I had a supervisor, and we talked about it a lot. And I think something that works for me is always being able to, like, I've always been able to separate myself from my clients. I don't really get triggered by my clients or their struggles. If I did, I wouldn't do it. If I was activated by what my clients are going through, it wouldn't even be on the table, but it hasn't been like that. I'm able to be present with them. I'm able to just be there with them. I'm able to provide safety for them. And especially for clients in all size bodies. And that's really important to me. And so I think my therapist saw that. And so she had no hesitation with me doing my work, which made me feel more comfortable about it. And we've always had like ongoing conversations, but it's obviously, like, I feel like for someone to say that anyone who has an eating disorder should not treat people with eating disorders is such a black and white, ridiculous way of thinking. And it's so individual. So for me specifically, it's worked. It's something I love to do. It's something I'm good at. And so, yeah, it's what I've done. I think in terms of, I've never, ever, ever shared with a client that I had an eating disorder. This was my secret. And I think there was definitely some shame that came along with it, but also I have a kind of like a relatively bigger platform on social media. And so once something is out there, it's out there. There's no taking it back. And I didn't want to share also because I don't want this to become my identity. It's taken so much from me already that I was concerned about like this being all that I was. And then also just the stigma and I was really afraid of losing my job and losing the ability to do what I love. And that was one of the biggest pieces. But I think I was so tired of living in secret. And more importantly, there were so many things I wanted to share about our field and about recovery and eating disorders that I just couldn't do on a personal level that I wanted to do so badly. And I just decided to share my story in April. I don't know exactly, like, I mean, I do remember one of my therapists calling my blog Avatar Shira, and something about the way she said it like clicked for me. And so I think there was that piece in it. But I did share and I did lose a lot because I shared, and that part is really, really hurtful and upsetting. But I also have been able to talk about all the things I've been talking about since then, which is so important to me. And it's also interesting how many therapists and dietitians reached out to me saying, I'm struggling, but I don't, like, I'm too scared to share. And so so many people are struggling silently, but there's so much stigma around being a professional with struggles that they won't share. I'm just the only one that decided to do that.
Yeah. And it's such a brave step that you took. And I think does really pave the way for other professionals who are struggling to reach out for help. And I can tell you, like, I do some professional counseling or consulting, like career coaching and stuff like that. And I definitely have had a number of dietitians and therapists reach out to me through that, saying that they struggle and are looking for support around it because they don't feel like they can tell anyone in their life, or people applying to be clients of mine who say that they work in the mental health field or as dietitians. And so, like, it's definitely common. It's a lot more common than I think people talk about. It's just, yeah, very few people are public about it because of the fallout that can happen.
Yeah, that part's been disappointing, but I also am very fortunate to have some amazing people in this field who fully have my back and support the work that I do, and that I just try to focus on that piece.
Yeah, that's huge. And I think having that community is so, so important.
Yeah.
I am curious to talk a little more about the stuff that you've seen in eating disorder treatment that is so antithetical to health at every size. And what is it, like, what's going on in these treatment centers and for professionals that we need to be talking more about and we need to be doing more as a field to address? Where does this come from at a larger scale?
I mean, I think it comes from fat phobia and unchecked fat phobia. And I think, like, even the entire way that treatment centers are based on, even to get access to treatment, often you need to be at a certain weight, and then treatment is kind of framed and based around that. And I think that forcing people to get weighed weekly, if not daily, especially clients in larger bodies that have been so traumatized around that, is so unfair. You're setting them up to be re-traumatized daily. I also think that, unfortunately, what seems to be happening is that a lot of people, their first jobs ever, they literally leave school and work in these treatment centers with no experience because they're paid so little. Like, these treatment centers pay the professionals so little. And so we're getting the people that are learning how to treat people with no experience, treating the most vulnerable people and people that need help the most, which is pretty concerning. So I think there's that piece. And so there's very little education. I remember one time when I was the second round of residential this year, I was just really struggling with my body and my body image. And the nurse just looks at me and says, "But, you know, guys would really find you attractive." And I just kind of like looking at her. And I was just like, I didn't say anything because I didn't. But I was just thinking, you think my eating disorder developed so I could look good for men? Like, I think, right. Oh my God. So there's just so little understanding. And then, like, okay, so my most recent or public experience in New York with the PHP that I went to, I specifically chose them because they market themselves as fully health at every size. The thing is, if you're going to put 5 clients in a room at lunch, point to 4 of them and say, "Please eat 100% of your meal," look at me and say, "Please eat 100% of your meal."
Oh,
you can't fucking call yourself health at every size. You can't.
No.
What message are you giving me? And so then I remember, so I'd have this like sandwich or whatever the hell it was on my plate. And I would just be like, it looked like a tornado hit it because I have an eating disorder. So if you give me a number, I'm going to be like, "Well, I can't do percent. I can't do percent. I have to do." And so my whole plate looked like a tornado. Then they'd yell at me for using food rituals and I'd get in trouble for that. And so there was, but meanwhile, you're creating this like traumatic experience for me. And I don't care if you like believe that I can also eat 100% if I'm hungry. If you tell me like that my body needs something different than everyone else at the table, you can't expect that to like do work, like figure it out. This is not working. And I think the worst experience was going to get ice cream and them telling all the other clients, "You all get scoops," and then looking at me and saying, "Get a scoop." And it's like, obviously, I have an eating disorder. I have a restrictive eating disorder. So I don't want to be eating ice cream in the first place. I'm already scared. But the fact that now you're telling me that I could only have size is now telling me that like my body is wrong. My body can only handle having a size portion. I'm there because I want to be able to eat all foods and be free of my eating disorder and enjoy dessert and whatever. But you're now giving me the message that I can't. And so you call yourself health at every size, but I'm sorry. Like, that's clearly a huge dissonance, you know?
Completely. Oh my God, it's horrible. The idea that one person should limit themselves to scoop, especially in the context of a bunch of people with eating disorders going out to challenge themselves to ice cream in the first place. And like, you're struggling with a restrictive eating disorder, like you said, that makes you not want to do it in the first place. And then this sort of dynamic of like, you're the one that's set apart, you're the one that has to eat less, everybody else is allowed to eat more. Like, that's just recreating that same trauma that it sounds like you experienced in childhood with your family and mm-hmm. in society in general. Like, well, there's something wrong with your body, so you need to do this other thing. Everyone else gets to have more freedom with food, which is just ridiculous and not true. And like, you're allowed to have as much ice cream as you freaking want. What is wrong with these people? And then to have the gall to call themselves fully health at every size is just beyond the pale to me.
And then to see people in our field promoting them and sharing their things and sharing their social media pages, it makes me die inside every single time.
I bet. Absolutely. I'm just curious with that, because you had all this knowledge of fat acceptance and health at every size going into treatment. And, but also you were struggling with an eating disorder. So there are these like two conflicting pulls on you, I'm sure, in those moments where you're like, eating disorder side wants to say, yes, of course, I'll just eat. Of course, I'll just get the scoop. And then your non-diet self-care side is saying like, no, fuck that. What are you doing? This is fat phobic, right? So how did you navigate that in the moment? And how do you think about it now that that's over?
I think it's an interesting question. I think like in that moment, I would freeze because it was just re-traumatizing based on a lifetime of all the things that I went through. A lot of times I wouldn't know why I was freezing or reacting the way I reacted until later. And I kind of would just try to write emails or share my feelings. But especially in this last place, everything I said was kind of turned around on me. There's a lot of gaslighting. And when I would try to express myself and use my voice and explain why things weren't okay, they would say, well, you're just malnourished or you're just really, really ill. And so then I started feeling like something was wrong with me. And I was just this sick eating disorder person that doesn't know what they're saying. And that was awful. But in this last place, my really close friend, my best friend, Sam Dylan Finch, he was with me the entire way and helped me find my voice when I couldn't find it. And that was so important to me because my team wasn't even necessarily standing up for me in the way that I had hoped they would stand up for me. And so it felt like I was doing this alone. And the reason why I think my team was just scared. They'd seen how severe my eating disorder got. And they just were worried, like, if you don't have this, then what are you going to have? And I know that it came from fear. But the bottom line is that I was being hurt again and again and nobody was standing up for me. So Sam helped me just like use my voice that entire month. I don't know what I would have done without him. And then a couple of colleagues in the field, once I shared my story, really were there for me in the most incredible way. But even like looking at what's going on for me now in my treatment, like I spent a year and a half or, you know, back in New York, back in California, New York, California, like trying to get help, then being hurt, then coming home and like trying to figure all this out and just continuing to not get better. And now I'm doing something new for the first time in my life. And I'm basically doing FBT with colleagues.
Family-based treatment, for those who don't know. It's like basically having supported meals every meal, right? So make sure you eat.
Yeah. So there's a lot more of just someone making the choices for me until the noise in my head gets quieter and I'm able to make better choices and decisions. But I think that it's not just the FBT or that aspect of it that's helpful. I think what's helpful is that I'm now, for the first time in my life, around people who not only don't care about the size of my body, but they also know that my body is likely going to end up in a larger place and fully support that. And so I'm safe in my body for the first time in my entire life. And I feel like that's just as important as the actual family-based treatment that I'm getting. And even right now I'm in PHP, partial hospitalization during the day. And my dietitian, who I think he's been on your podcast. Mm-hmm. So he's a friend and a colleague and someone I've known, but he's also someone that I just fully feel safe with and supported by, and know that I'm just, for the first time in my life, I have permission to eat. And I think that that's the piece for me that's feeling the most healing and helpful and supportive at this point. It's not just like everything else.
It makes total sense because you never got that message. You never got that modeling of, yeah, it's okay to eat whatever you want. It's okay to eat as much as your body needs and feels good and, you know, honor your hunger and that it doesn't matter what size your body is. You're allowed to have that as a basic human right. We all are, no matter our body size.
Yeah. And I think like, it's not just about, you know, I know this is what I do. I can help other people. I believe in health at every size with all of my heart. I believe in all of the things that I talk about on my platform with all of my heart. And I still have a mental illness. It's not just about knowing differently. It's some of it is also just so trauma-based that it's like a physical, it's like a body response. And so I think having people around me that understand that and don't further shame me because I would be in treatment and then I would have other therapists say, well, you're a therapist, you know better. And then feel so much more ashamed of the fact that I was struggling. And now for the first time, not only am I around colleagues and friends who fully support me and I feel safe with, but I also feel safe with in the way that they're not judging me. They understand that like, I do believe in what I believe in and what I talk about. I also just have a mental illness.
Yeah. And I think the trauma piece is so important to highlight too, because like it's that feeling of physical safety. There's this like mind body sense of lack of safety in trauma and trauma responses. And that sense of safety can only really be restored through reparenting, kind of helping that part of you heal and not be re-exposed to the same trauma that created it in the first place. And it sounds like that's what you're finally finding with this community of colleagues that is supporting you.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's so also important for anyone listening to here, especially people who've been listening to this podcast for a long time, but still struggling. I definitely get emails and letters from people who say, you know, I'm fully on board with this at an intellectual level. I get health at every size. I get why it's so important. I'm vocal against diet culture in my own life now. And I'm still restricting or I'm still using other eating disorder behaviors. Like, what's wrong with me? You know, that's their framing of it. And it's like, nothing is wrong with you. Of course, you're still struggling. And, you know, because of that deep trauma, of course, it's going to take a lot more than just intellectual knowledge to undo.
Exactly. I just hope people can have more self-compassion for themselves in this process. Like, nobody asks to be tormented by disordered eating and eating disorders. It's nobody wants this, you know, and there's reasons for it. And I'm working on a self-compassion piece and I hope that everyone else can like start to do that as well, because this shit is hard.
And so deep. And so, you know, it's been around for so long, right? Like, especially what you shared earlier really strikes me, that you don't have any memory of positive relationships with your body, that from as early as you can remember, people were telling you that something was wrong with your body and you needed to change it in order to deserve love. And when you've had messages like that your entire life, you don't really have that memory of intuitive eating and freedom around food to like reconnect with and help you keep going. It's just, you don't really know what's on the other side. You know, you have to just sort of keep going through the difficult process of recovery with faith that you can get to the other side and feel safer and better in your body, that that's possible for you.
Right. Which is a really scary thing to kind of leap towards.
Yeah. What do you feel like has helped facilitate that for you, making that leap?
You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm still very much in this process of just every day is a struggle, to be honest, right now. But I do think that like what we talked about, like the community piece and the support and the love that I'm getting now feels really healing and helpful and important. But I do think that I'm still very much, I mean, I'm doing things that I've never done in my whole life in terms of like progress, in terms of behaviors. But I also think I'm still very much struggling every day. And it is scary to me to think about like, will things ever feel easier? Like, will my brain ever just get quieter? And I hope so. And I'm fighting for this because for me, I'm not going to settle for some quasi semi recovery. Like, the only times I've had sort of recovery were when I just transitioned into being obsessively healthy or obsessively all those orthorexic tendencies and all things like that. And that's just not, you're still living a shrunken life when you do that. And I won't settle for that. So I'm just, I don't know, taking it a day at a time and just doing my best and trying to have self-compassion around this whole process, because I have had my eating disorder for 21 years. And so it's not going to be a few weeks or even a few months of hard work. It's going to be a long time and just trying to be patient. I'm still very much day by day, hour by hour right now.
Yeah. So it's kind of like having to take the leap of faith again and again. Every moment you decide whether or not to use a behavior or do something different.
Right. And I also have a lot of support right now. So I'm not on my own for not, I mean, I have like support at every single meal at this point, which is probably what I need right now.
Yeah. And not just any support, but it sounds like the type of support that really helps you feel safe and feel not judged and scrutinized the way those other experiences sound like, you know, like being told to eat 100% of your meal. Just like how much more scrutiny can you feel, you know, like versus, people who are just there for you and supporting you and eating whatever, much, however much you want.
Yeah, I remember being horrified the first time the person I'm staying with now, that she like handed me something that I had in the program I was in and was like, here you go. And I was like, no, I don't eat the whole thing. She's like, every person eats the whole, this is like normal. And I was like horrified, but okay, normal is a terrible word, but you know what I mean? Like, I just want to be able to eat a freaking sandwich. Like, that's just ridiculous and bizarre to be counting every last percentage and calculating. That's insane. So yeah, it's just funny to see my response based on like my experiences in treatment and then kind of relearning what people do around food.
Oh yeah, completely. I think those kinds of treatment meal plans are really damaging to a lot of people. And I have had a couple clients and participants in my online course tell me recently that, like, you know, here's this meal plan that I followed in my residential treatment that I'm still kind of loosely following in my mind. Like, can we talk about this meal plan? Part of me thinks that it's like ridiculous and diety, and part of me thinks that I'm not supposed to be eating any more than this. And then I look at the meal plan and I'm like, this is horrifying. This is not enough food. And it's also like ridiculous combinations of foods that nobody would eat. Literally, one person showed me this meal plan that was like, had options for lunch that included a sandwich with that basically didn't have anything in it. It was like, I was like, where's the sandwich?
What? Sad.
And it's like whoever wrote this is clearly disordered themselves. And yet it has the imprimatur of like, this is an authority figure telling me to eat this. This is from a treatment center. And therefore this is what recovery should look like. And I'm like, I don't know anybody who is not actively eating disordered who doesn't eat like a sandwich with stuff in it.
Oh my God. And it gets confusing because you think you're going to these professionals for help. Of course, they know what they're doing. And then when you feel hurt, you just feel confused because maybe something's wrong with me. But really, something is so wrong with the entire system. And I would say, to be honest, 99% of our treatment centers out there are incredibly problematic. I maybe know one that's not. And that's really scary and concerning that we just, and then we'll be like, oh, this person needs a higher level of care. Let's throw them into this program. Do you know where you're throwing them into? Like,
right. It's out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think needs to be done? Like, I know we have a lot of professionals who listen to this, especially like early career professionals. And I think that really heartens me to think that people are getting this kind of health at every size education early on in their career and can go forward without as much diet culture baggage. I won't say without all the diet culture baggage, because we all have some from growing up in diet culture, but being able to challenge it early in your career, I think, is such a gift. Like, what can folks who want to make a difference in this field do, do you think, to change the trajectory at treatment centers to make this better?
I mean, there's so many things. I think first of all, we need to be examining our own internalized fat phobia and really take a hard look at that. I think it's very easy to say, no, but like, I really believe all bodies are good bodies, hashtag whatever. But I think we really need to do some more work around that. And I think even just the way, I don't know who's going to be in charge of this or make changes, but the way food is set up in treatment, like there maybe should be a minimum of what people need to eat, but that's a minimum. If somebody wants more food or if somebody is hungry, like there should be no hesitations or questions. Like they should be able to eat more food. And I think people might have a hard time saying that they're hungry, especially when they have an eating disorder. There's a lot of shame around that. And so there needs to be like safety around those kind of conversations. And I feel like the exchange system is, I'm sorry, we need to do better than that. We really, really do. It's, you should maybe be able to pick from like a few different options of like different snacks and meals, instead of like, oh, well, I had X amount of this food group, so now I have to have this food group, even though it makes no sense in your meal because it has to fit in with your exchanges, like we just talked about. And like, no, like what sounds like a good snack? Great. Like, let's have it. You know what I mean? So I feel like the food piece needs to be worked in. And I think, I don't know how this is going to happen, but people need to be paid more so that the burnout and the level of turnover is decreased, because that inherently comes with so many problems. I mean, and then of course the whole weight and the whole piece of people not being able to access treatment often if they're not like in a low BMI body, according to insurance and the DSM, needs to be changed. The entire way we frame eating. I also don't understand why we need these categories. I think, how many people do we, I know you know this because you're both in the field, like how many people go from anorexia to bulimia to binge eating back and forth, like one to another, like why does it matter? Like all people who have disordered eating and across any kind of disorder, they're all worthy of help. So I think that piece is also problematic. Like, and then putting people in a separate like binge eating track or something. Are you segregating fat people? Like, I'm confused. Because, you know, the person that was in the binge eating track now, maybe 6 months ago, had anorexia. So, like, it's all the same. It's all the same shit.
It's all the same shit. And it's, yeah, just under a different guise, but with a lot of the same roots that go back to fat phobia, go back to diet culture, and it's fat phobic and food phobic beliefs that it's instilled in people. And so, yeah, putting, especially, drives me up a wall to have people being cordoned off into this like separate binge eating track when it's restriction that's driving the binging, y'all.
Exactly.
Like,
it's
don't.
All restriction.
It's all restriction. Like, I forget who said it on the podcast. I think maybe it was, I don't know. I don't want to misquote, but someone on the podcast had a great quote that was like, all eating disorders are restrictive eating disorders. Mm-hmm. It just all goes back to that restrictive mentality, even if there's not active restriction happening in the moment. There's probably a restrictive mindset. There's probably a restrictive history that's driving the behaviors now. And so even if a person is in a phase where they're mostly binging, they're probably still restricting at some level, mentally, physically, or both. And oftentimes it is both, even in eating disorder treatment for binge eating, because like you were just illustrating, it's like people get put on these ridiculously low meal plans that don't meet their needs. And so that is a biological driver of binging too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember my second round of residential this time, there was a girl there who the second the staff would turn around, she would sneak candy in the closet. And I just remember my heart broke for her. Let her have candy. Like, she doesn't need to be sneaking it. Like, give her permission. But it was like, no, she couldn't have the candy because she had to have her whatever crappy other food groups that she needed to fit into her meal plan. And that's not what she wanted. And so she would be sneaking the food that she wanted to eat because she wasn't given permission to eat the foods that she, and it was just, it made me so sad to observe this whole thing.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. And yeah, the fact that a treatment center that should be a place that's the most free with food, the most encouraging of someone having something like candy and challenging the beliefs that tell them they shouldn't or whatever. It's like, if you can't find that kind of freedom in a treatment center, then something is really wrong with our treatment centers.
Exactly.
One other thing that I am really curious to talk about that you shared a little bit on your blog about is, or in, maybe in Facebook groups and stuff too, is like the exorbitant cost of treatment and the fact that to be able to afford to go to a treatment center, which as we've discussed is a very problematic and imperfect solution to eating disorders in the first place, can also be cost prohibitive, so that people don't even have access to higher levels of care unless they have thousands or tens of thousands of dollars disposable income or just income at their disposal. And so, you know, I'm curious what your experience has been with that and sort of thinking about the cost of eating disorder treatment as kind of one of the untold tolls that diet culture takes on us, that, you know, diet culture as a life thief stealing our time, our well-being, our happiness, also steals money in this very specific way.
Yeah, I think as a kid, I was on my parents' insurance. And so I was on really good insurance. And we still had insurance would pull me out after like 6 days or 7 days, again, probably due to my body size. And that's obviously not enough time to be in treatment. And so I'd come out and then be in the same boat and then be put back in a little bit later if insurance. I remember the only time I ever got like an appropriate length of stay. I was 17 and my mom had an insurance advocate, and she basically, they got the attorney general involved. It was months of work that probably I didn't have, you know, and finally we got, basically we scared them into paying for every single day that I technically had with my insurance because they were scared of being sued. And not everyone has a parent that's willing to fight for them. Not everyone has the time or the energy or the capability. There's so much involved in that. And when you're already struggling with an eating disorder and it sucks up every last bit of your energy, having to battle with your insurance is not something that everyone has. And then later on, when I had my own insurance, because I wasn't on my parents' plan anymore and I was an adult, I may as well not have had insurance because they covered literally nothing. So I remember calling up like three different treatment centers, and the only ones that my insurance would cover, and all of them said, sorry, like we can't take you. One of them, they only took people with a certain BMI. The other one said, you know, you're really ill and you need inpatient, but insurance is going to deny you because of your BMI. So we can't take you at all. And then the other treatment center, like my insurance, they were just having issues with. So I remember hanging up the phone with the last one and thinking, I'm done. Like, I remember I had spent like all of the only energy I had. And at that point, I just so badly wanted help and so badly wanted to get better. And I spent all that energy trying to figure out how to get it and was turned down again and again. And I remember just thinking, okay, I'm done. I guess whatever happens to me happens to me. And the only way I got treatment was because my dietitian found me a place that was willing to give me a scholarship. And if I didn't have that, like, I honestly don't know if I would be alive right now. That's the truth. And it breaks my heart because I was very lucky to get a scholarship, and so many people die because they don't have access to the treatment they need. And even outpatient is a fortune. My therapist is $200. My dietitian's another, you know, it costs like hundreds of dollars a week. And it's basically like more than a salary, like in addition to everything else. And it's so inaccessible. And at the same time, as a therapist, I can see like it's really hard to take insurance and be able to make your private practice work. So I see it on both ends. And our system is failing people every single day.
Yeah, and it's failing the people who need care. It's also failing the people who are trying to make a living as a private practitioner to be able to take the clients who need it. And really, the whole system is so broken.
It really, really
is. I'm really glad you were able to get a scholarship. And I can see why that probably took a lot of fighting and effort. And, you know, not everybody has that kind of access. There's so many people wanting a scholarship and so few spots.
Right. And even when I was in my 20s and really struggling, there was a time where my dietitian was like, I think you need a higher level of care. And I was also very much in denial, but there was a part of me that just thought, what's the point? So my insurance is going to cover me for a week and then kick me out. I don't need to deal with that process. Like, I knew I needed more time than my insurance would allow for. And so I just couldn't imagine putting in all that energy and then not getting what I needed yet again.
Yeah, because to be cut after 6 days or something is just ludicrous. Like, who in their right mind would think that someone with an eating disorder could get better in that little amount of time?
Exactly.
Especially when it's so much more about undoing those underlying thoughts and the trauma, but also like giving you meal support on a consistent basis so that you don't have the physiological drivers to continue restricting, and like that you can become re-nourished and therefore more able to engage in treatment too. Like, it's all of it. You have to have all of those needs met in order for treatment to actually work.
Yep. And now, like, I'll be coming home from California in about a month. And I mean, I'm still going to need probably a good amount of meal support. And that could go for like $200 a pop, you know, and I'm hoping to be able to get it like on a sliding scale if I do like a bunch a week. But and I'm also like, my friend started a GoFundMe for me, and I never, ever, ever thought I'd agree to that. And it feels so uncomfortable, but now I have money that I never had before to be able to put towards my treatment. And that's also another privilege. So I will be using it for meal support. But if I didn't have that, I would not be getting the care that I needed. I wouldn't be able to afford it.
It's really fucked up that as a culture and as a country, we tell people to get their medical care paid for, mental health care paid for by crowdfunding. Like that's sort of a common phenomenon, you know? It's ridiculous. I mean, more point in favor of a single payer healthcare system, or at least a better version of the one we have now that actually gives coverage to people with conditions who need help.
Yeah, exactly.
Ugh, I'm so sorry you've had to go through this. And it sounds really, really painful on top of an already traumatic history with food and your body and all the stuff. But also, I'm so grateful for you speaking out about this and really pulling back the curtain on what goes on in these treatment centers, because I feel like not enough people are in positions where they can do that. And it's, yeah, really, really important that you're telling your story.
Thank you.
So, tell us where people can learn more about your work, and are you still blogging about this stuff as you go through treatment as well? And you know, can people follow along with what you're experiencing?
They can definitely follow me on like my social medias. My Instagram is The Shira Rose. I have a website, also my blog, theshirarose.com. And my work in terms of my private practice and things like that, that I'll be restarting in New York in a couple of months. Right now it's on Psychology Today. And I work in Chelsea, but I will be making a new website, which I can share the details. I think it's going to happen in the next month or two. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that you shared, Shira. I really appreciate your work and everything you're doing in the world and everything you're doing to just kind of open people's eyes and minds to this whole world that goes on in eating disorder treatment centers that people are not aware enough of. And I also think, you know, I don't want anyone listening to take away from this that like eating disorder treatment centers are totally fucked. And so I might as well not try to recover, right? Like it's both. It's they're fucked and we need people still need support and treatment.
Yeah. And there are amazing people out there like willing to, it takes a little bit more work maybe, but you can find incredible professionals willing to help you.
Right. Exactly. And like you, it sounds like you have now, you've got a really great team around you of people who've been on the podcast, right? Like,
I think everyone basically, which is a good sign. Exactly.
It's a really good sign. Yeah. So if anyone is listening who is struggling and needs help, listen to the podcast, check out the past guests. I actually have a list of past guests that I made to like recommend, you know, here are my top recommendations, basically, if you need eating disorder support or diet culture recovery of any kind, like go here. I think it's at ChristyHarrison.com/providers for anyone who needs it. So we'll put that in the show notes as well. But yeah, it's really cool that you've been able to find this community and get the support you need. And I really hope that more and more providers start walking in this path that those you're working with have set out and those before them in the fat acceptance movement and health at every size movements have laid out for all of us.
Yeah. And I really appreciate the work that you do as well. These are the kinds of things that give me hope that maybe things can be better.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So that is our show. Thanks again so much to Shira Rosenbluth for joining us on this episode. And thanks to you for listening. If you're looking for some tips and guidance to help you get started on the anti-diet path, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. If you've gotten something out of this podcast, please help us reach more people who need to hear this message, the anti-diet, pro-health at every size message, by sharing and subscribing on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platforms, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, et cetera, et cetera. They're all there. If you go to ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe, you'll see all the platforms. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. You can also leave us a nice rating and review in your podcast provider of choice, which is another way to help new listeners find out about the podcast and is always so, so appreciated. To get full show notes from this episode, including all the resources we discussed, plus a full transcript, go to ChristyHarrison.com/216. That's ChristyHarrison.com/216. And to get the transcript, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and enter your email address. This episode was brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to make peace with food, break free from diet culture, and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. A big thanks, as always, to our editor and sound engineer, Mike Lalonde, our community and content associate, Vinci Chui, and our administrative assistant, Julianne Watasik, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show every week. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography and designed by Meredith Noble, and our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.